It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's been freezing lately, but the students at Concordia University in Mequon don't mind. We'll find out why in this week's edition of Curious Wisconsin.
First, though, each year, monarch butterflies travel up to 3,000 miles from North America to their winter home in Mexico. Aside from being a longtime tourist attraction, the migration is a biological phenomenon that some scientists say has been happening for 10,000 years.
Yesterday, the World Wildlife Fund, along with Mexico's Environment Department, announced that the annual migration is in danger of disappearing for good.
The number of monarch butterflies wintering in Mexico this year has dropped to the lowest level since studies began 2 decades ago.
Here with us to help understand what happened to monarch migration is Lincoln Brower. He's research professor of biology at Sweetbriar College and professor of zoology at the University of Florida. He also works with the Monarch Butterfly Fund in St. Paul. Lincoln, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
Well, how big is the drop in the monarch butterfly migrating population based in Mexico this winter?
Well, migration this fall is nothing short of a total disaster. We have records going back for 21 years, actually going back to 1977, but they're not full detailed that early. The numbers are down to the point where we're really concerned that we may lose the whole migration altogether. And given the fact that the migration has probably been around for the last 10,000 years since the Ice Age, losing it is just unthinkable.
Is there a seasonal variation from year to year, or is this beyond what you've seen in that kind of annual fluctuation?
Well, the average is around 12 hectares per year going back for this period of time, and the biggest year was 21 hectares. Now, when I say 21 hectares, what I mean is that the way we measure this is we go down there and we locate a given butterfly colony, which is up in the forest on top of the mountain, and we walk around that forest and we measure the number of trees that monarchs are settling on. And so a hectare of trees is about 2.5 acres, and we know that under normal circumstances there are about 50 million butterflies per hectare. And so that back on that year, about a decade ago, there were 21 hectares, which would have been over a billion monarch butterflies. And this year, it's down to an all-time low of just a little over half a hectare. And so we are really frightened that we're going to lose the migration.
The big question, why? Why is this happening?
Well, I think that we know from past history. I've been studying monarchs in Mexico since 1977. I've been down there almost every year. And over the years, on the early years, there was a lot of deforestation that was degrading the habitat of the butterfly so that the survival ship was going down from year to year to year. But the Mexican government has pretty much put a stop to that. And what has happened in the last decade, creeping up on us, is the use of herbicides with genetically engineered corn and soybean crops. And it turns out that the main breeding habitat of the monarch butterfly is in your area and the surrounding area in the Great Plains, basically in what used to be our grassland ecosystem. And corn and soybean is planted over tens of thousands of acres. And they're now all these crops are genetically engineered, so they're totally resistant to Roundup and herbicides. And so the seeds are planted, they germinate, then the fields are sprayed, and it kills every other single living plant in those fields so that you end up with a complete total monoculture. Now, from the monarch's point of view, what is lost is milkweed. When monarchs fly north on their migration in the spring, they locate milkweeds and they lay their eggs on them. And that's the only plant that monarch butterflies are able to feed on. So this technology, this industrialized agriculture, is just wiping out the entire food chain, the entire food web, basically destroying the natural ecosystem for the sake of these single crop plants. It's a tragedy.
So as they try to make their way north and then back south again, the gaps between food sources are just too big to migrate?
Right. Well, when they come back from Mexico, they have a very interesting migration. They come back, they're 5 or 6 months old when they come back from Mexico, and they come into Texas and they lay their eggs on Texas milkweeds. And then the new generation that's produced in about 3 weeks works its way up into the great, into Wisconsin and up into the Great Lakes region. And there they lay eggs across the milkweed flora that's all over the place. It's a very, used to be a very common plant in that whole region. And then there's another generation that takes about a month to develop. And over the course of the summer, there are three generations. And then in the fall, the shortening day lengths turn off the reproductive biology of the butterflies, and it tells them fly south up to 4,000 kilometers back to Mexico. And they go back to the same trees that their grandparents were on the previous year. And they've never been there before, and that's one of the really amazing aspects of this migration. So we're talking about building up the numbers of butterflies over the course of three or four generations, and the last generations are in the Great Plains region, and their food supply is just being destroyed by this industrialized agriculture.
Do you see
it? We've got to stop it. We've got to mitigate. We've got to get going some kind of compromise.
If we don't do anything, I mean, can we see a near future where we do not see monarch butterflies in Wisconsin and the rest of the region?
I think that's exactly what's going to happen if we continue with this agriculture on the scale that is presently used, and probably will be even worse in the future. But, you know, I think it's a much bigger picture. The loss of this very common, very well-known, fantastic butterfly is a symbol of saying that we are messing up our environment. And eventually, it's what I call a canary in the cornfield. The monarch is the canary in the cornfield. If we wipe that out, it's telling us something about we're wiping out our own environment, and it's going to come back and bite humanity really hard in the not-too-distant future. So I think the monarch is a symbolic creature that is telling us the way we're handling the environment with industrialized agriculture is just plain not the way to go.
Is this a symbol of our prairie lands here in the Midwest?
Well, that was the original habitat that was the milkweed plants are really interesting plants. There are actually 130 species in northern Mexico and the United States that monarchs feed on, and some of the main species that they feed on occur in the prairie ecosystem. And so monarchs were probably evolved with and were tightly associated with the very place where everybody lives out in that wonderful part of the USA.
So you said maybe there's still some hope if we change some things. What would need to change to keep the monarchs migrating?
My colleagues and I belong to an organization called the Monarch Butterfly Fund. It's on the web if people want to access it. But we are going to mount a campaign while we try to convince people to get in touch with their county agents and people that are in control of highway mowing and highway herbiciding, and try to do that in such a way that it will be benefit monarchs and other insects and other pollinating creatures as well as the monarch. And if you look up the number, the mileage of roads in the eastern United States, it's over 1 million miles. And so that if you have all those highway verges that are protected, and maybe we can get some farmers. There are a lot of farmers who are worried about these herbicides and their effect on the environment. People know what's going on. Then how do we get mitigation? Well, maybe the thing to do would be to say 100 feet on the side of all fields will not be sprayed, so as to retain. We've got to get compromises with the agricultural community, and I think there's a real opportunity to work with the federal highway system and the state and the county highways.
I know some people in Wisconsin plant butterfly gardens. Does that make a difference, or is that just too small a patch to make a big difference?
Well, that's the problem. It's definitely important in terms of education, in terms of awareness, and I'm all for it, but it's not sufficient in terms of the bulk of food necessary to support the billion butterflies that's supposed to be migrating to Mexico.
Anything you want to leave us with, something now that you've got a chance to say about the monarch migration and get people thinking about this?
Well, I hope that people will start rousing up and talking to their county agents, and we will put on that website methodology that has to be sort of developed locally in working with people and getting natural history groups and various bird clubs and so forth, all the people that are interested in the environment, to really put pressure on the state and federal highway system so that we can come to a compromise and promote the natural environment to a much greater extent. People are just letting this happen because they're not aware of it. And awareness is really an important part. And if we lose the monarch, it's going to be a real tragedy for a lot of reasons.
Lincoln, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Lincoln Brower. He's research professor of biology at Sweetbriar College, professor of zoology at the University of Florida, and as he mentioned, he works with the Monarch Butterfly Fund in St. Paul.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This week, classes were canceled all over Wisconsin thanks to the bitter cold. But students at Concordia University in Mequon had it pretty good. They get to classes through underground tunnels, sometimes in shorts, even in sub-zero weather.
In today's Curious Wisconsin, we'll get a tour of the tunnels with Craig McCarthy, public relations and publication manager at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So how long have Concordia's tunnels been there?
Well, you know, they're actually an original part of when this facility was built back in the early 1960s. And so the Sisters of Notre Dame were originally here, and the tunnels were part of that original structure of the buildings. But obviously, over the last 15, 20 years since we've Concordia's been here on campus, we've actually added some buildings, but we've still maintained the tunnel system connecting the existing buildings to some of the newer buildings that we've put up.
Wisconsin is a cold and often windy state, but we don't have a lot of tunnels. Why did Concordia, or the buildings that preceded it, have these tunnels?
Well, I mean, from everything that I've been told from people who've been here for a while at the university and kind of know the history of the building, this is the way that the engineers wanted to and the architects wanted to build the structure. They wanted a bunch of buildings sort of clustered together in the center of the campus, and then they wanted a road that kind of travels around the campus. And so with the buildings in the center and kind of closely, very close in proximity to each other, it's easy to connect the buildings with the underground tunnels. And from what I've been told, the nuns used to use them to travel between buildings. They would roller skate and ride bikes and do all sorts of things between the tunnels. And it's kind of fascinating now that when I walk underneath and look at some of these things, I just imagine, you know, nuns and other people on roller skates and bicycles kind of traveling between buildings. And, if anybody were to see photos or travel, they're very wide. So you can push huge carts through with, maintenance people are pushing, big carts with equipment and things through the tunnels. And it's just quite fascinating when you really think about it.
Now, so do people still use them for recreation? Do they roller skate down there, or is that not a good idea anymore?
I don't think I've actually seen anybody. I mean, I'm sure somebody could do that, but now with almost 2,000 students on campus at any given time, probably not the safest thing to do would be to be roller skating or bicycling through there. But I did see somebody on a Segway once going through.
Wow.
So it was interesting.
How extensive is this tunnel network? Is it just, a couple tunnels here and there? Or can you go a fair ways in it?
To think that somebody the distance would be close to 4 miles of tunnels. So I think if you're talking about our tunnels underneath and then with our hallways sort of both levels, I mean, it's about almost 4 miles of hallways and tunnels that students can walk through when they're going between buildings and classrooms.
So does anybody ever get lost down there?
I'm assuming they do. It probably took me 6 months to a year when I started here to finally realize where I was going. I would always get lost, but that was, I guess, part of the fun of it. Kind of creepy, too, when you're walking and you don't really know where you're going and it's getting darker and darker and darker, and then you're somewhere where you have no idea where you're at.
Oh, boy.
Do you have students who spend days, maybe weeks on end, particularly in the winter, I guess, without setting foot outside?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I've talked with some of our student workers here, for example, that work in our department. I've been told, they said, sometimes I think they forget how cold it is outside because they say it's been days since they've actually had to even step foot outside. So Yeah, quite fascinating when you think that, you know, during this time when it's, you know, below zero, that you may forget at times, you know, how cold it actually is out if you're a student here.
So do the students tend to like that, that, you know, they're underground and they don't really have to grit their teeth and go outside, or does it make them feel sort of insulated?
I mean, I don't know. Everything that I hear, I think it's pretty favorable, because I feel like the students, you know, there's not maybe that sense of, oh my gosh, if, you know, if you maybe wake up a little bit late in the morning and it's a couple minutes before class, it's kind of, you know, you can, you know, jump out of bed and kind of, you know, get ready pretty quickly and then still make it to class in time without having to kind of, you know, layer up and do those types of things that you would normally have to do if you were traveling, you know, outside, or going a distance across campus if you had to go out into the elements. So I think it's kind of a, you know, a comfort factor, I would think. And then, you know, I also think that's kind of how students these days want to dress. You know, they want to be able to wear comfortable clothes. You know, it's joking saying flip-flops and shorts, but honestly, when I first started here, it was February, and I was kind of scratching my head, not realizing that, yes, they are traveling through the tunnels, because I said, God, that student must have been freezing coming in from outside wearing flip-flops and shorts. But realizing now that that's how they're able to get between the different buildings is through the tunnels and the hallways.
We've seen a lot of cancellations this year, more for cold than for snow.
Yeah.
Concordia, I'm imagining some people have to drive to work. Do you still cancel classes when the weather gets too bad?
Yeah, unfortunately, that was the one thing it doesn't happen here. It's very rare that it ever happens here on campus. But, yeah, I sent out the information on Monday about the tunnels, and, of course, Monday night, I got the email that we were canceling classes on Tuesday morning. So.
Really?
That's why Jinx does.
Nice Jinx, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. But in a way, it was more of a safety thing, and also because there were, obviously, we do have a percentage of commuter students, and they were just having car issues and things like that, so a lot of the students weren't able to, you know, commute to campus.
So I've read that Concordia is 13th in a list of 21 coldest colleges in the country.
Yeah.
This is according to a website called College Prowler.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder, you know, why other campuses don't have tunnels too.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I can't speak to what the mindset was back in the early 60s when they sort of, you know, did the construction on this. But I think it was people who actually were kind of, you know, forward thinking and kind of had that foresight to think about, you know, we're in a pretty cool location here in Mequon, because we're actually right along Lake Michigan on a bluff that overlooks the lake. So I think we're a little bit more susceptible to some of those, what could you say, lake effect winter conditions, the winds and, you know, some of the blowing snow and things like that. So I think that kind of, you know, makes it that much nicer that we have the tunnels and a way for students to get around without having to go outside.
Are these tunnels a recruiting tool? Hey, you could go to another college in Wisconsin. We've got tunnels.
Yeah, you know what? And it's actually funny, because I was told by somebody that prior to me starting here, they actually used the phrase in a marketing campaign that said, at CUW, you can wear shorts in January. So I would assume that maybe would be a kind of a hook for, you know, those, you know, 17, 18-year-olds who are kind of deciding. And you got to remember, too, that students may be coming from other parts of the country that maybe have never experienced the cold weather. So Florida, California, those types of places. So, you know, that may be a deterrent for them wanting to come to a cold location. But then if you realize, like, hey, you can come here and you can still kind of maintain your relatively warm, you know, environment during the winter, it's kind of an added bonus, I would say.
So do you think this is the future for all cold Midwestern colleges as we go through erratic weather patterns? Some of them winters might be warmer, but some of them might be getting even more brutal.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think that we're probably in a unique position that, you know, our buildings are so close together, because I would imagine doing any sort of underground tunnel system in a very large campus across miles and miles and miles would be fairly expensive. So I don't know if this is going to be necessarily the wave of the future, but who knows.
Craig, I got to say, thinking about this, all I can think of is this is a great opportunity for games. Do you ever have any big campus-wide tunnel hide-and-seek tournaments?
You know what? I don't know if that's been the case. You know, I'm usually not around here at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. But I do know that there are some, stories about ghosts and things that kind of haunt the tunnels. So it's kind of interesting to hear some people talk about some of these, you know, these stories about the tunnels being haunted by spirits and things like that.
So, we'll have to leave those ghosts as a tease for another time. Yeah. Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, no problem. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Craig McCarthy, Public Relations and Publication Manager at Concordia University, Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the latest on efforts to provide mental health care to people just released from jail.
First, when I say the word economics, it's possible your eyes glaze over as you think of charts and equations and international banking regulations.
Our next guest set out to spice things up by sharing the economic lessons he learned when he joined the online dating market.
Paul Oyer joins us now. He's professor of economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. His new book is Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics, I Learned from Online Dating. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. People glaze over when you talk about economics.
Well, I'm sorry.
I find that hard to believe.
I forgot you were listening when I said that. Before we delve into the online dating, a lot of us might think of economics as something out there in the newspapers, on Wall Street, something the government works with. Part of the point of your book, I think, is you want us to see it in our everyday lives. Why is that?
Well, I think it is in our everyday lives. And I think that a lot of people, when they think of economics, they think of two things that are very important but not central to a lot of us as economists. One is macroeconomics, so the things you talked about that are very, you know, interest rates and the state of the economy. I don't happen to do any macroeconomics. And the second thing is I think a lot of people associate economics with money. And that's fair enough. But to economists, money is just kind of a boring, convenient way to make transactions work better, but it's not interesting in and of itself. And so what I really liked about the topic of online dating is economics is, like you said, going on around us all the time. We're constantly trying to improve our situations, not necessarily our financial situations, although that's often part of it. And online dating gives you a chance to see that, even though there's absolutely no money changing hands.
Even though, prospective dates aren't paying each other cash, can we still think of online dating as a market?
Oh, it's a classic market in many ways. So there are a lot of marketplaces that are more traditional in that you just go there, you're buying and selling a commodity. What makes online dating a particularly interesting market, and it shares this with the job market, is that you have two sides that are trying to match each other and find and sorry to get really dry and technical, but potential life partners, just like jobs, are what you would call a differentiated good. No two are the same. And so the market's very complicated and interesting because you're trying to find you're trying to match parties rather than just sort of buy or sell the same thing at a liquid price or something like that.
You didn't just research this. You actually did it in your real life. But were you thinking like an economist right from the start, or were you just a guy at first and it started to dawn on you like, hey, this economics stuff I do could be helpful here?
It was exactly the way you put it at the end there. I didn't go in thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to go research this market at all. I went in saying, okay, well, I'd like to find a new girlfriend. And I started doing that. And then I said, oh, wow, this is a really interesting market. This is just like, you know, I'm a labor economist. And so the parallels to all markets were interesting to me, but the immediate parallels to the job market just kind of jumped out at me. And I couldn't help but sort of think of it in that perspective from then on.
Well, as you mentioned, this is a differentiated, I think you said, market, whether we're looking for,
good, yeah.
for a differentiated good. So everybody's different. A big challenge, I think, is probably when do I settle on what I've got with me right now, love the one you're with, I guess, as the song says, versus holding out for the soulmate or Mr. or Ms. Right.
Yeah, that's one of the very fundamental challenges in terms of that's where economics is really playing into your everyday life in terms of finding a life partner. You know, we have this romantic view of the world that I'm going to hold out for the one in quotation marks. Well, the one doesn't really exist. I hate to be
what?
The one to point this out. But what we need to do is hold out for somebody who's really great. You know, I'm not saying you should settle for the first person who walks through the door, but every day unfortunately, we're trading off. Economics is the study of scarce resources. And a really important scarce resource in our lives is time. And so when you go out to look for your next life partner, you can invest a fair amount of time in doing that. But your resources, your time, are not infinite. And, you know, you also have to, you know, take care of your house and take care of your kids if you already have them and things like that. So you have to trade that off. And at a certain point, you have to stop and say to yourself, you know what, I've got this partner or potential partner, and he or she is really great, and could I maybe do a little bit better or find somebody who is a better, more perfect fit for me? Sure, in the whole world, I know somebody like that probably exists, but I've got to get the car washed and these other things. And at a certain point, you just have to say to yourself, it's time to move on. And again, that applies when you're looking for a house. It applies when you're looking for a new appliance, something like that. There might be a better one out there, but at a certain point, you have to do the cost-benefit analysis and say, good enough.
So this is diminishing returns. I could invest more and more time, but at some point, the improvement I get out of that time is so minuscule, it wasn't worth the initial investment.
But you put that beautifully. I would agree with everything you just said.
All right. Hey, maybe I can be an economist after all. Forget this radio gig. Well, when somebody is first deciding, okay, I'm going to go on the online dating market, what's a good first step? What's a good economic piece of advice to get rolling?
Well, I think the first step is picking your website if you're going to do online dating. So if you're just going out in the market and you want to use traditional means because you like the face-to-face approach better, that's fine. But assuming you're going to go to an online market or an online dating, you're going to use online dating, you have to pick the right website. And I think economics would tell you want what we call thick markets. You're likely to do better in what we would call a thick market, which is just another way of saying a big market. Now, this is a place where online dating has some parallels to other markets, but some differences as well. We like to go to thick markets for things like stocks and bonds and commodities, you know, oil and pork bellies and those sorts of things as well. But there we like thick markets because they lead to more price competition and the buyers and sellers, there's more buyers and sellers. You're more likely to get the allocation of the goods to whoever can pay the most, and everybody's pretty sure they're not getting ripped off if the markets are big and liquid. In a differentiated good like the job market or the market for life partners, you want a thick market, which in this case means going to a big website like eHarmony or Match.com or something relatively large like that. And the reason for that is because all the goods are differentiated, if you will, you want a larger selection. The likelihood that we're going to end up that you're going to end up in a happier relationship is going to increase the more chances we have of finding somebody who's more like the type that you're going to fit well with. So a thick market, more alternatives lead to better things. Now, this can be problematic. Too much choice can be a problem. So if you go to a market that's too big and you're overwhelmed by the choices, that's a problem. But if the online dating sites can do anything to make their algorithms helpful in terms of narrowing down the choices once they've, you know, from the many, many options they could give you, then that works out efficiently. So anyway, the simple answer to your question is, everything else equal, choose a bigger dating site.
Can we thicken the market even further by doing more than one dating site at a time?
Yeah, I did more than one dating site at a time. And, you know, that leads to, now, not everybody's going to want to do that because there's additional costs. The more, each dating site has its own costs. You have to set up your profile. You have to do this and that. But each one, I chose a few different sites because each one, there are, despite the fact that you want the big, thick market, there are some quirks to the individual sites which have certain advantages as well for certain, I don't know, types of people you might be looking for or for certain ways you want to present yourself. So sure, use multiple sites, use big sites. That's where I would definitely, that's what I would say.
A challenge in a lot of realms of economics, whether buying a stock or buying a used car, is the problem of limited information. You're only getting the info probably that the car salesman or the online dater wants to give you. How do you economically manage that challenge?
you learn the hard way eventually. No, you manage it. I think the simple answer is, so we can look at this from both perspectives. We can look at it from the perspective of how do you avoid How do you deal with the fact that people are going to be worried about the information you're presenting them with, and then how do you deal with it when picking partners? And I think from the perspective of how, you know, when I look at an online profile, I have to keep in mind that the exactly what you just said, that people are only giving me the information that they want to give, and that, in fact, they have incentives to not be entirely honest. So being somewhat skeptical when looking at an online profile, and yet at the same time keeping an open mind, those are very important in terms of thinking about what are reasonable options to look at. Now, when I think about, but I, in some ways, I think the more interesting part of information problems is how do I deal with the fact that when I create my profile, people are going to make assumptions about me based on what I put on my profile. And that's where I think, you know, you have to think not just about what do I worry about the other whether the other person's telling the truth or revealing everything. I want to also think about if I say certain things, what assumptions will people make about me? So an example I talk about in the book is, you know, I was when I first went on an online dating site, I was separated, my divorce wasn't final, and for a lot of people, they made assumptions about my readiness to enter a new relationship and things like that. And so you have to think a little bit about assumptions, or if you know if in any way you reveal on your profile that you haven't had a serious relationship in a long time, people will make assumptions along those lines as well. So hidden information is a real problem in this market, and just like the job market or whatnot, sometimes we learn the hard way about that.
We're talking to economist Paul Oyer about his new book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating.
Coming up, our next guest studies the difficulties in improving mental health care to people just released from jail.
You can join the show at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about online dating. If you have a question about how to apply economics in online dating or elsewhere in your daily life, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation after this look at headlines with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Paul Oyer, economist and author of the book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating.
And you can join in. Have you ever tried online dating? Do you have a question maybe about how economics could help you? Or maybe a lesson you learned that could apply? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Paul, wanted to get into some more of the questions you raise and tackle in the book. We've heard the phrase before, opposites attract. Should we have that in mind as we're looking on online dating profiles?
Oh, God, I hate to keep ruining everybody's... this is why we're known as the dismal... Economics is known as the dismal science. Opposites may attract in certain dimensions that are harder to measure, but in the more standard manner, it's just, if you look in the data, people end up pairing off with people that are very much like themselves. And this is true certainly in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of income and things like that. You know, a lot of that comes from where do you meet your partner? Well, you might meet them through online dating, but you also meet partners through work and through education. And so we end up partnering off with people who look a lot like us in those dimensions. There's an economics term, positive assortative mating, and it just shows that if you think about almost any measurable trait in terms of any sort of sociodemographic type of trait, people end up, on average, with people who look pretty much like themselves. It's a little bit unfortunate because all this talk about, like President Obama the other night talking about a lot of discussion of income inequality. One of the barriers to income inequality, I think, is the fact that rich people marry other rich people, and that, you know, makes it harder for... So if you're a high school dropout, you're very unlikely to end up with somebody who makes a lot of money or has more education and therefore have an opportunity to move up in that manner.
But our personal online dating lives, you're saying, is not the place to try to break through that barrier?
Well, you could try, but at the end of the day, people don't, and I think they don't end up pairing off in that manner. Even I certainly wouldn't say you shouldn't try it. I'm just telling you that empirically, both on preferences for people like ourselves socioeconomically and in demographics, those are true both in in online dating and who people are attracted to through on online dating sites, and then in any other sort of way that you look at how people pair off.
Email from Roxanne in Madison. I've used the site OkCupid several times with no luck. What suggestions do you have for trying to maximize your time by quickly weeding out potential partners without wasting your time by meeting them all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's a really good point. So that's the million-dollar question, if you will. So I would say a little bit of investment in time in terms of who you write to is very useful. So I've actually had quite a bit of success on OkCupid myself in the past, although I met my girlfriend on JDate. But OkCupid has these very interesting personality questions, which that was part of why I was very interested in them. But the answer to the question, I think, is two things to keep in mind is, one is when you're looking at the messages people have sent you and deciding which ones to respond to, I would put a little bit of the idea, an economist would put a little, through the idea of signaling, would put a little bit of weight on whether the person personalized their message. So if you just get a message saying, hey, I like your profile, I'd love to meet, you know, if you have other people you can respond to, I would ignore that one. I'd be looking for more like, hey, I looked at your profile. I'm also interested in basketball. I don't really like that TV show you mentioned, but, you know, I think that's funny that you do. Or, you know, something that shows a little bit of investment. That would be one thing I would think about. And then on the other side, in terms of who you write to and so forth, again, I would spend, rather than sending 100 messages saying, hey, I think your profile looks great, you know, send 10 that are a little more personalized.
Again, that sounds like the job market, as you mentioned earlier. If you have a bunch of very generic resumes in front of you and then a couple that are tailored to your workplace, which way are you going to go? The one that showed a particular interest in your workplace.
Right. I mean, so if the last email you just read had said, what can I do to improve my odds of finding a good job, I would say spend more time on 10 cover letters rather than sending 100 generic cover letters.
Talking to Paul Oyer about the economics of online dating. I know we have some online daters out there. Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to share your experiences. Maybe get some advice from an economist. Maybe not a place you'd have gone to look for it, but it could be useful. Hey, you mentioned JDate, and I was wondering, you mentioned the idea of going for big websites, dating sites with lots of people, but there are, it sounds like, a growing number of very specific websites to maybe reach for more people that might be better fits. How do you weigh those two options?
Yeah, that's a good point. So JDate is a Jewish dating site, and I went on it not because I cared much whether or not I'm Jewish, but not at all serious about it. And I didn't care that much about whether my partner was Jewish or not. But I went on it because in the area I live in here in Northern California, and when you're looking in the market for relatively educated people, which, you know, despite my argument that maybe we need less positive assertive matching, that's what I was looking for. JDate is a pretty thick market. There are a lot of people who are both Jewish and the types I might have been interested in. So JDate is specific on the one hand, but it's still a big enough, thick enough market. The things I stayed away from were, I'm a big tennis player, but I didn't see any reason to go on tennisdate.com, which does exist.
Really?
Because there's just not a thick enough market of people who are so interested in tennis that they would focus that on their search. So you have to think about the specialized sites that have done well are ones that are reaching a group that is both big enough and that cares so much about their partner being in that group. So things like Christian Mingles have been very successful. And some of the over 50 dating sites, which are more specific, those have also been quite successful.
So you want things that are deal breakers. If I'm a tennis player, exactly. I'm not, and somebody else isn't, I think we could overcome that difference in a relationship.
Exactly. No, exactly. So the deal breakers, and they have to, but it's even a deal breaker, if it's not something that everybody's going to think is a deal breaker, then it's not going to lead to a thick enough specific site.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Kathy on the line in Cedarburg. Kathy, hi.
Hi.
What's your story?
Well, I met my husband through eHarmony, and I guess the reason I think it's interesting is because he's the first person I responded to and the first person that I met, and we were married within 3 months, and we have 3 children, and we're really happy. And I don't have a whole lot to compare it to, since I was only on the, you know, e-dating or whatever for a very brief time.
So, Kathy, congratulations, first of all. And were you just really lucky, or were you just ready to settle on the first guy that came along online?
Oh, please. No, I was really happy. I think it was very much a situation of serendipity, and it just happened to be e-dating, so.
Well, it was serendipity, but it from an economist's point of view, I hear your story and I say, remember, you got to be in the market to succeed in the market. So, you know, you put yourself out there, you took the time to set up your profile, and sure, you got lucky. That's the way life works. I have my job because of some lucky things that happen. But, you know, if you hadn't sort of said, I'm going to go look, so you looked for a market that happened to work very well, and there was some luck in that, but at least you sort of went for it.
Well, thank you for the call, Kathy. Not everyone has that kind of luck up front. Suppose somebody's been on for a long time, they keep striking out. What do they do to evaluate maybe what they're doing wrong?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah, I think that's where you need to start thinking about the types you're... So this is a time to go back and sort of do that self-assessment of what types of assumptions are people making about me. So the people who you end up, you know, trying with and not striking out, they probably have certain characteristics that for some reason your profile appeals to them, and you need to think about, and they make assumptions that you're a certain type that you are not. So you might want to then go back and think about, okay, how can I redirect? There's a hidden information problem. I'm a certain type that is, and it's not coming across in my profile, and how can I change that?
So suppose we've got success, we're getting ready to try to lock it down and get married. What should we be weighing before we make that decision?
Well, the thing you have to think about is, yeah, that's a good question. I think, the general principle that you have to think about settling, to use the word that everybody hates, at a certain point you need to do that. And exactly when is the right time to settle? That's where you need to use a little bit more of your own introspection and your own cost-benefit analysis about how long, you know, how well this is going to work out. I mean, the one thing to keep in mind is when you are locking in a relationship for the long term, how sure you are about it, you know, that there's your incentives change on that over time. So when you're very young, you should be much more picky.
All right.
Because you have a longer time with the person.
Paul, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. This has been fun.
That was Stanford University economist Paul Oyer. His new book is Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating.